He talked for a long time about what an extraordinary person she was. It made me suspicious that she was dead, and I started crying. Viola took the phone and translated until I was fit to talk again. The minister promised me she wasn't dead. He would call me the minute they knew anything at all. He was fairly sure the Contras had taken her by mistake, not knowing she was an American citizen, and now were probably confused as to how to release her without generating too much bad publicity. He asked, had I called the President of the United States? In the meantime, Hallie's letters still came to the post office box. I knew she had mailed them before she was kidnapped, but their appearance frightened me. They looked postmarked and cheerful and real, but they were ghosts, mocking what I'd believed was a solid connection between us. I had staked my heart on that connection. If I could still get letters like this when Hallie was gone or in trouble, what had I ever really had? I didn't read them. I saved them. I would open them all once I'd heard her voice on the phone. I wouldn't be fooled again. At some point between Christmas and mid-January, Grace became famous. The several hundred piñatas planted in Tucson had grown into great branching trees of human interest, which bore fruit in the form of articles with names like "This Art's Not for Breaking" and "What Piñatas?" in slick magazines all over the Southwest. The Stitch and Bitch Club's efforts in papier-mâché became a hot decorator item in gentrified adobe neighborhoods like the one in Tucson that Hallie used to call Barrio Volvo. It was the birds that caused the stir, but because it was there, people were also reading my urgent one-page plea for the life of Grace. Where Mayor Jimmy Soltevatus's repeated calls to the press had failed, Stitch and Bitch succeeded. Our story became known. Hardly a day passed without some earnest reporter calling up to get a statement from Norma Galvez. The club designated her the media spokeswoman. Doña Altea was more colorful, but given to unprintable remarks. Ditto for Viola, who was even more unprintable because she spoke English. But when a scout crew from CBS News came to town, they wanted the Doña. They sat in on a meeting at the American Legion Hall and zeroed in on the Stitch and Bitch figurehead with her authority and charm and all she represented in the way of local color. They got some of the meeting on tape, but made an appointment to come back on Saturday with a crew to interview the Doña in her home. Norma Galvez would be, for safety's sake, her interpreter. By the time Saturday morning came, when CBS rolled into town in their equipment jeeps like Jesus into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday, the whole town was anticipating the visit of what Viola had been calling the BS News. There were about 50 of us packed into Doña Altea's living room, just there to watch. The Doña looked as she always looked, tiny, imperious, dressed in black, with her long white braid pinned around her head like a crown. As a concession to the cameras, she clutched an embroidered shawl around her shoulders. She refused to close the restaurant, though, and it was lunchtime, so there were still comings and goings and much banging of pots. Cecil, the sound man, had to run his equipment off the outlet in the kitchen since it was the only part of the house that had been wired in the 20th century. "Ladies, we're just going to have to be cozy in here," he said, turning sideways and scooting between two Altea sisters to reach the plug. "Son of a," he said when one of the sisters tripped over his cord and unplugged it for the third or fourth time. The Altea in question stopped in her tracks and looked for a minute as if she might deck him, but decided to serve her customers instead. She was so burdened with plates, it's lucky Cecil didn't get menudo in his amps. The director of the crew had the Doña sit in a carved chair that normally stood in her bedroom and held the TV. Two men carried it out, sat her down in it, and arranged vases of peacock feathers at her feet. "Just cross your ankles," the director told her. Norma translated, and the Doña complied, scowling fiercely. She looked like a Frida Kahlo painting. "Okay," he said, wiping sweat off his forehead. He was a heavy man dressed in Italian shoes and a Mexican wedding shirt, though his mood was not remotely festive. "Okay," he repeated, "let's go." There was a camera on the interviewer, and two cameras were on Doña Altea, bright hot lights everywhere. A crew member dabbed the interviewer's nose and forehead with a powder puff, eyed the Doña once, and backed off. The interviewer introduced himself as Malcolm Hunt. He seemed young and wore an outfit that suggested designer label big game hunting or possibly Central American revolutions. He probably meant well. He carefully explained to Doña Altea that they would edit the tape later, using only the best parts. If she wanted to go back and repeat anything, she could do that. He suggested that she ignore the cameras and just speak naturally to him. Norma Galvez translated all this. The Doña squinted at the lights, fixed her scornful gaze on a point just above the kitchen door, and shouted all her answers in that direction. Cecil took it personally and slinked around behind the steam table. Mr. Hunt began, "Doña Althea, how long have you lived in this canyon?"
"Desde antes que tú cagabas en tus pañales."
Norma Galvez shifted a little in her chair and said, "Ah, since before your mother was changing your diapers." The Doña scowled at Norma briefly, and one of the Alteas laughed from the kitchen. Mr. Hunt smiled and looked concerned. "When did your family come to this country?" The Doña said something to the effect that her family had been on this land before the gringos took over and started calling it America. The prospectors came and mined out the damn gold, and the Black Mountain Company mined out the damn copper, and then they fired all the men and sent them home to plant trees, and now, naturally, they were pissing in the river and poisoning the orchards. Mrs. Galvez paused. "A long time ago," she said. Mr. Hunt lost his composure for the first time. He made an odd guttural noise and looked at Mrs. Galvez, who spread her hands. "You want an exact translation?" "Please." She gave it to him. It wasn't the afternoon anybody had expected. Malcolm Hunt kept adjusting his posture and his eyebrows and appearing to start the whole interview over, framing new questions that sounded like opening lines. "The Black Mountain Mining Company is polluting and now actually diverting the river that has been the lifeblood of this town for centuries. Why is this happening?"
"Because they're a greedy bunch of goat fuckers."
Actually, Mrs. Galvez said so-and-sos.
"And they got what they wanted from this canyon, and now they have to squeeze it by the balls before they let it go."
"They're actually damming the river to avoid paying fines to the Environmental Protection Agency. Isn't that right? Because the river is so polluted with acid?" The Doña waited for Norma's translation, then nodded sharply. "What do you think could stop the dam from being built at this point?"
"Dinamita."
Mr. Hunt appeared reluctant to follow this line of questioning to its conclusion. "In a desperate attempt to save your town," he said, trying another new tack, "you and the other ladies of Grace have made hundreds of piñatas. Do you really think a piñata can stop a multinational corporation?"
"Probably not."
"Then why go to all the trouble?"
"What do you think we should do?"
She had him there. Malcolm Hunt looked stumped. He looked from Norma to the Doña and back to Norma. "Well," he said, "most people write their congressmen."
"No sé. We don't write such good letters. I don't think we have any congressman out here anyway, do we? We have a mayor, Jimmy Soltevedas, but I don't think we have any congressman."
She pronounced the word in English, making it stand out from the rest of her speech like a curse or a totally new concept.
"CI," she went on.
"If we do, I haven't seen him. Probably he doesn't give a shit. And also, we don't know how to use dynamite. What we know how to do is make nice things out of paper. Flowers, piñatas, cascarones, and we sew things. That's what we ladies here do."
I smiled, thinking of Jack following old habits, turning around three times on the kitchen floor and lying down to dream of a nest in the grass.
But why peacocks? What's the history?
Malcolm persisted after hearing the fully translated explanation. Tell me about the peacocks.
What do you want to know about peacocks? The Doña asked, giving him a blank look.
The full Spanish name for peacock is pavo real, royal turkey, but Mrs. Galvis let that one slip by.
How did they get here?
Doña Altea lifted her head, adjusted her shawl, leaned back, and put her hands on her knees, which were spread wide apart under her black skirt.
Hace 100 años, she began, and Norma translated.
More than 100 years ago, my mother and her 8 sisters came to this valley from Spain to bring light and happiness to the poor miners who had no wives. They were the 9 Gracela sisters, and she allowed Doña Altea to name them.
Altea, Renata, Hilaria, Carina, Julieta, Ursulina, Violeta, Camila, Estrella.
She pronounced the names musically and slowly, drawing out the syllables and rolling the R's. They were the names of fairy princesses, but the story in her high, sustained voice was biblical. It was the genesis of Grace and of Hallie and me. Our father's own grandmother, mother of Homero Nolina up in the graveyard, was one of those princesses. The red-haired, feisty one. I could picture her barefoot, her hair curly like Hallie's and coming loose from its knot. I saw her standing in the open front door of her house, shaking a soup spoon at her sister's arrogant children who came to tease her own. Perhaps she was Ursulina, the little bear. When Hallie and I were little, I used to make up endless stories of where we came from to lull her to sleep. She would steal into my bed after Doc Homer was asleep, and I would hold her, trying to protect her from the wind that blows on the heads of orphans and isolates them from the living, shouting children who have inherited the earth. We came from Zanzibar, I would whisper with my mouth against her hair. We came from Ireland. Our mother was a queen, the queen of potatoes. I could never know the truth of my mother, but there was another story now, another side. I closed my eyes and listened to Doña Altea with the joy of a child. I don't know what they heard on the CBS News. I heard a bedtime story 30 years late.
Chapter 22. Endangered Places. It rained and rained in Gracela Canyon. February passed behind a mask of clouds. It seemed like either the end of the world or the beginning. The orchards, whose black branch tips had been inspected throughout the winter for latent signs of life, suddenly bloomed, all at once, pears, plums, apples, quince, their normal staggered cycle compressed by the odd weather into a single nuptial burst. Through my classroom window, I watched drenched blossoms falling like wet snow. Water, in Grace, is an all-or-nothing proposition, like happiness. When you have rain, you have more than enough. Just as when you're happy and in love and content with your life, you can't remember how you ever could have felt cheated by fate. And vice versa. I knew, abstractly, that I'd been happy, but now that I was in pain again, that happiness was untouchable. It was a garish color picture of a place I had not been. Memory runs along deep, fixed channels in the brain, like electricity along its conduits. Only a cataclysm can make the electrons rear up in shock and slide over into another channel. The human mind seems doomed to believe, as simply as a rooster believes, that where we are now is the only possibility. But it isn't. In spite of the promise of plenty that dripped from the rooftops and gushed down Gracela Canyon's ravines throughout February, the winter rains would soon dry up. Then there would not be another drop until July. During those brittle months, the taste and smell of rain would be lost to us,
beyond the recollection even of children and the deepest root tips of trees. That is the way of seasons in a desert place. Only the river ran continuously. The river was Grace's memory of water. We heard nothing from Hallie. First, I tried to tell myself she was already out of danger. In the past, the 2-week delay of her letters had caused me to keep a distrustful eye on Hallie, like a star so many light years away it could have exploded long ago while we still watched its false shine. Now I tried the reverse psychology. We would hear soon that she'd been safe while we worried. But we didn't, and I gave over to panic. I began to call Managua every week. The Minister of Agriculture, whose secretary now knew me by voice, said there wasn't any reason for me to fly down to Nicaragua. There was nothing I could do there but wait, which, he implied, I was doing badly enough where I was. He really was not unkind, just frustrated, like any of us. He pointed out that Hallie was an exceptional person to those of us who loved her, but not an exceptional case. The Contras made daily forays across the border to attack workers in their fields, sometimes even schoolchildren. Thousands of civilians had died. If you came here, he said, you would see. Every home had a framed photograph on a table that stood for a fresh, empty space in the family, he said. Teachers and community workers were particularly at risk. He said I might try making Hallie's status known to the general public in the United States. It could pressure her captors to show restraint, or, he warned me frankly, it could do the opposite. I knew nothing else to do, so I wrote letters. Emelina helped. We papered her kitchen table with letters in progress. I drafted mine on stationery from the Grace High School principal's office, but the letterhead intimidated Emelina, who preferred lined paper from her kids' loose-leaf notebooks. Viola put a request to the Stitch and Bitch Club, and after that we had volunteers in Emelina's kitchen for nightly letter-writing sessions. I dictated the main ideas, and then they all got the hang of it. I looked up who had voted for sending the guns and who had voted against, and either way we tried to work it in. I expect we sent out more than 1,000 letters. When we lost track of which congressmen we'd written, we wrote them again. We wrote radio stations and any other public entity we believed might be reading its mail. Sometimes I stopped and laid my head on my arms. Emelina would massage the back of my neck and say nothing because we both suspected words were beside the point. There may have been publicity we never knew about. We didn't get the New York Times in Grace. I do know there was a short piece in the Tucson Morning Paper, in the money section, of all things, right next to an article about how to reduce your mortgage with twice monthly payments. There was a small, smiling photo of Hallie, who was identified as a former employee of the University Extension Service. The reporter had called up the Minister of Agriculture, as I'd suggested, and said that he alleged she'd been kidnapped by agitators based in Honduras. This was followed by a much longer quote from a state senator who said the Nicaraguan Civil War was a tragedy and that the United States was doing its best to bring democracy to the region and that no U.S. citizen could go there without expecting to be caught in crossfire. The reporter, believing I would be pleased, sent me the clipping, along with a note wishing my family all the best. The breadth of his ignorance made me feel hopeless, as I've sometimes felt in dreams, when the muscles dissolve and escape is impossible. I wept uncontrollably all day. At school, I asked my students to read Silent Spring for an hour while I put my head down on my desk and cried. They were subdued. I suspected people in Grace of walking around me on tiptoe now, the way a town might avert its eyes when its resident crazy lady hikes up her skirt and scratches an itch and swears at the blackbirds watching from a telephone wire. I stopped going to Doc Homer's for dinner. We were in the worst position to comfort one another. I guessed he could go on about his routine. That had always been the core of his resilience. but I don't think I'd slept a single night since she'd been taken, and I was reaching an abnormal state of exhaustion. I fought off hallucinations. Late one night, Hallie appeared in my bedroom doorway, very small, looking up at me, with those same eyes she used to ask without words to crawl into my bed. "Hallie, I'm trying so hard, but I don't know how to save you." She turned on stocking feet and walked back into the dark. I got up and rifled my desk drawers till I found the newspaper clipping with her picture. I looked at it hard, trying to convince myself that Hallie wasn't a child. I had the black and red afghan bundled around me, but I felt chilled and hard as a frozen branch. My hands shook. I tucked the clipping into an envelope and wrote a note to the President of the United States, begging him please just to look at her. "This is my only sister," I told him. "I'm coming to understand responsibility. You gave those men a righteous flag to wave, and you gave them guns. If she dies, what will you tell me?" I licked the envelope and sealed it. I knew the address by heart. We began to get letters back, to the effect that the matter would certainly bear investigation. They weren't form letters. Each one was typed by a different secretary, but they all said the same thing. It surprised me to see how a meaningless phrase repeated again and again begins to resemble truth. In the middle of that gray month, Emelina's youngest son learned to walk. I was alone with him when it happened. The sun had come out briefly as I walked home from school, and the baby and I were both anxious to be outdoors. Emelina asked if I could just not let him eat any real big bugs, and I promised to keep an eye out. I settled with a book in the courtyard, which was radiant with sudden sunlight. The flowers were beaten down, their bent-over heads bejeweled with diamond droplets like earrings on sad, rich widows. For quite a while now, Nicholas had been cruising the perimeters of his world, walking confidently from house to tree to lawn chair to wall, so long as he had something to hold on to. Sometimes what he touched was nothing more than apparent security. Today I watched the back of his red overalls with interest as he cruised along a patch of damp, tall 4 o'clocks, lightly touching their leaves. He had no idea how little support they offered. He spotted a hummingbird. It buzzed around the red tubes of a potted penstemon that stood by itself in the center of the courtyard. His eyes followed the bird as it darted up and down, a high-strung gem. Nicholas wanted it. For a long time, he frowned at the brick path that lay between himself and the bird, and then he let go of the wall. He took one step, and then more, buoyed up by some impossible anti-gravity. After 2 steps, the hummingbird was gone, but Nicholas still headed for the air it had occupied, his hands grasping at vapor. It was as if an invisible balloon floated above him, tied to his overall strap, dragging him along from above. He swayed and swaggered, stabbing one toe at a time down at the ground, pivoting on the ball of one foot, and suddenly the string was cut and down he bumped on his well-padded bottom. He looked at me and screamed. "You're walking," I told Nicholas. "I promise you it gets easier. The rest of life doesn't, but this really does." I stayed out there with my book for the rest of the afternoon, surreptitiously watching as he tried it over and over. He was completely undeterred by failure. The motivation packed in that small body was a miracle to see. I wished I could bottle that passion for accomplishment and squeeze out some of the elixir, a drop at a time, on my high school students. They would move mountains. The Stitch and Bitch Club was now wealthy beyond historic measure. On the heels of the blockbuster piñata sale came a steady flow of donations from the outside. Lulu Campbell, the treasurer, had always kept the club's funds in a coffee can in the back of the Baptist grocery where she worked. But when the volume of cash filled 12 baby formula cans, she grew nervous. Lulu opened an account at the bank and turned the passbook over to Doña Altea, whose years as a top-notch restaurateur had made her somewhat more comfortable with affluence. The cash languished in its vault while the women pondered its meaning. Having sent their peacocks out into the world like Noah's dove over the flood, they waited for the world to inspire their next move. Inspiration came in the guise of an art dealer from Tucson. His name was Sean Reidhart, and he was a funny, charming little man who understood people as well as he understood beauty. The spectacular popularity of the Grace Piñatas, some had been resold for as much as $500, moved him to make a pilgrimage to the source. Mr. Reidhart was already an expert, and he became a connoisseur. Before he ever set foot in Grace, he could already recognize the works of several individual piñata makers. Of particular value were those made by Mrs. Nunez, who had been so resourceful with her Compton's Children's Encyclopedia. He wanted to know this town better. I met him on his third visit when he came to meet Viola. There was no school that day. I believe it was the birthday of a president, and I was staring at clouds. Emelina didn't bother me on my bad days. I was allowed to do nothing, not even pretend to feel better, which I recognized as a rare act of human kindness, and I appreciated it. I spent the morning sitting on Emelina's front porch, watching our neighbor, whose roof was on the same level with our floorboards. We were having another brief break in the rain, as if the clouds had called a timeout to muster their resources. Our neighbor, Mr. Pye, was taking advantage of the moment to climb up and inspect his roof. "Got a few leaks," he called out in a friendly way. I waved back, unsure of how to answer. I watched the top of his engineer's cap bob down the ladder out of sight and shortly thereafter appear again. Mr. Pye negotiated the ladder with one hand while balancing a small, old-looking cardboard box against his hip. It made me think of the surprises coming out of the kiva at Santa Rosalia Pueblo. Mr. Pye knelt near his chimney pipe and opened the box like a birthday present, carefully lifting out some shingles. They were green and shaped like the ace of spades, an exact match to the ones on his roof, only a little brighter, grass green rather than the green of old bronze. I remembered once, months ago, looking at that roof of antique shingles and assuming them to be irreplaceable. Curiosity overcame my lassitude. "How'd you match those shingles?" I called out. He looked at me, puzzled. "Where'd you get the new shingles? They're a perfect match." He examined the shingles in his hands as if noticing this for the first time, and then called back, "Well, they ought to be. They're all from the same lot. I bought 200 extras when I put this roof on." "When was that?" I asked. He looked up at the clouds. I don't know whether he was divining the weather or the past. "Right after the war," he said. "That would have been 46. Just then, Mr. Reidhart came walking up the road under a navy blue umbrella. Maybe it was still raining down the way where he'd just come from. He walked directly to the front porch where I sat, jauntily hopped up the steps, stomped his feet delicately a few times as if to knock off mud, though his shoes were immaculate, and extended his hand to me. I'd expected to spend the day in numb, depressed solitude, and now I felt uncomfortably honored to sit at the end of Mr. Reidhart's long line of effort, like a princess in a tale of impossible tasks. Although I was fairly sure he hadn't come all this way looking for me. "Sean Reidhart," he said. He had white eyebrows and bright green eyes, an appealing face. "Cody Nolene." I shook his hand. "I've heard about you. You're the piñata collector." He laughed. "I've been called many things in my time, but that's a first. I'm looking for Viola Domingos." At my invitation, he sat down in the only other chair on the porch, wicker, of doubtful character. "She's not here," I said. "Nobody's home today. Viola and the kids have gone down to the church. They're having some kind of a big party down there today, painting the saints." "Painting the saints?" Mr. Reidhart extracted a largish blue handkerchief from the pocket of his tweed jacket and cleaned his wire-rimmed glasses with extraordinary care. I watched for a long time, mesmerized, until he glanced up at me. The statues of saints in the church, I explained. I guess they have to get freshened up every so often, like anybody else. The women paint the saints and the kids paint each other. He replaced his glasses and observed the rooftops and treetops that led stepwise down the hill. Mr. Pye had his back to us now. He was industriously tacking down shingles he'd secured for this purpose 10 years before Hallie was born.
"Quite a place," Mr. Reidhart said finally. "How long have you lived here?"
It wasn't an easy question to answer.
"I was born here," I said slowly. "But right now, I'm just on an extended visit. My time's up soon."
He sighed, looking out over the white path of blossoming treetops that led up toward the dam.
"Ah, well, yes," he said. "Isn't everybody's? More's the pity."
At first, the Stitch and Bitch was divided in its opinion of Mr. Reidhart. While he was graciously received into the kitchens of half the club members, where he drank tea and stroked his white mustache and listened in earnest while the piñata artists discussed their methodologies, the other half, led by Doña Altea, suspected him of being the southwestern equivalent of a carpetbagger. But for once, the Doña judged wrong. His intentions were noble and ultimately providential. When the club assembled in March for its monthly meeting in the American Legion Hall, Mr. Reidhart was the guest speaker. He was supposed to lecture on folk art, which he did, but mostly he talked about Grace. He told these women what they had always known, that their town had a spirit and disposition completely apart from its economic identity as an outpost of the Black Mountain Mining Company. During the last century, while men labored underground to rob the canyon of its wealth, the women up above had been paying it back in kind. They'd paid with embroidery and peacocks and fruit trees and piñatas and children. Mr. Reidhart suggested that he had never known of a place quite like Grisela Canyon, and that it could, and should, be declared a historic preserve. There existed a thing called the National Register of Historic Places. The landmarks on this list, he said, were protected from the onslaught of industry as if they were endangered species. He allowed that it wasn't perfect. Listing on the register would provide, he said, a measure of protection from demolition or other negative impact. In other words, he said, a man can still shoot an elephant, even though it has been declared endangered, and the elephant will still be dead. But the man will come out looking like a very nasty guy.
"But really it's not our houses that are going to get endangered by the poison in the dam," Norva Galvez pointed out. "It's the trees."
Mr. Reidhart replied, "Your trees are also historic." He knew all the ins and outs of becoming a historic place. He explained where to begin and where to go after that to see that the river would run clean and unobstructed. There was a fair amount of bureaucracy involved, but the process was reasonably speedy. "Considering the amount of publicity that has already been brought to bear," he said, gesturing toward the window, or possibly the invisible airwaves of CBS, "I think it could be done in less than 2 years." He said we would need to document everything to prove the age and architectural character of the community. "All the photocopying," he said, "photography, and so forth, can be expensive. Sometimes communities apply for block grants." After a brief silence, Viola said succinctly, "We don't need any block grants. We're rich." And that was that. At some point during the spring, I got a letter from Carlo. He'd finally made plans. He was going to Telluride. The clutch had gone out on our old Renault, and he'd junked it. He hoped I wasn't attached. He was thinking of getting a motorcycle, unless I was coming to Telluride, in which case we'd get another car. I was in such a state, running on so little sleep and such dead nerve endings, I didn't know what to think. I knew I'd have to make plans soon, and I was touched that he still took me into account when he made his move, as if we were family. But I felt nothing when I read his words. Maybe it was just the same nothing there had always been between us. The words seemed to be coming from a very great distance, with the same strange compressed tone as a satellite phone call. I looked carefully at each sentence and then waited for it to register. All I could really get clearly was the name of the town, with its resonant syllables, Telluride. It sounded like a command. I'd become estranged from Lloyd after our trip, of course, because of Hallie. I felt guilty for being away when the call came. Lloyd and I had been laughing and making love for all those days while the news was laid out like a corpse in Doc Homer's house. I didn't even call him the night we got back into town. We hadn't wanted the vacation to end, so we just went straight to Lloyd's house and spent the night. Surprisingly, I'd never slept in his bed. Lloyd's house was entirely his own, a mobile home set up against the cliff of Upper Gressela Canyon on a masonry foundation he'd built slowly himself over the years. Through his efforts, the stonework had gradually grown up over the metal shelf, so that now it was pretty much a rectangular stone house overgrown with honeysuckle vines. Leafless for winter, the honeysuckles made a lace curtain over the bedroom window. Their shadows left faint tracings on the walls, which I watched all through the bright, moonlit hours of that first night home. Lloyd held on to me tightly in his sleep. I couldn't find sleep myself, but I was happy. The next morning, he left at dawn for a 7-day stand in Yuma, and I walked down to have breakfast at Emelina's. But of course, as things turned out, I didn't eat. Not that day or the next. By the time Lloyd got back from Yuma, I was too far gone to be touched. It was Yuda Dell on the phone, telling me Doc Homer had gone to Tucson for a CAT scan. She called it a skin the cat. I sat up in bed, cradling the phone and pulling the red and black afghan around me. School was out for the spring break, so life had lost what little sense of order daily work could still impose. "When did he go?" I asked. "Just this morning?" What I wanted to ask her was, why did he tell you and not me? But I guess I knew the answer to that. "No, honey, he went yesterday. He took the bus." Yuda seemed industrious on her end of the phone, even as she spoke. Every few seconds she paused, and I could hear a high ascending sound like cloth ripping. "Did he tell you how long he'd be gone?" There was another rip, then Yuda's voice. "Honey, he didn't tell me a thing about it. I don't think he wanted anybody to know. You know, Doc, he don't want anybody to make a fuss." Rip. "But he come over and asked me to look after the house. If you or anybody was to come looking for him, he said just tell them he'd gone to Tucson for the weekend to get some medical supplies." Rip. Now, I knew that didn't sound right. I never heard of him doing that before. And you'd think whatever we all got along without for 40 years, we could get along without till the judgment, don't you think? So I said, "Doc, are you pulling my sleeve? There's something up, ain't it?" And he said there was more to it. He was going to get tested for his Alzheimer's and get a CAT skin test done on him. "Oh, well, that's good," I said. It was a challenge to follow this trail of reason. I could perfectly picture Yuda, her large face, the cheeks tightly packed and shiny like a plum. I rubbed the top of my head and looked at the clock with astonishment. I'd fallen asleep around 4 a.m. and slept an unprecedented 7 hours. "So, honey, what I'm calling you for is..." Rip. "I've been itching to get into that house and clean. I know he hasn't been up to it, and I don't mean any offense. Lord knows I think the world of Doc, but I expect he needs somebody to get up there and clean. And I was thinking now'd be a good time, but I didn't feel right about just going in. I've had the key all this time ever since I used to keep you girls. He never did want the key back." She paused. "But I thought I'd better call and see what you said." The key was more or less a symbolic matter. He didn't lock his front door. Nobody in Grace did. "I think the cleaning's a good idea," I said, "but I also think he'd be mad." I hesitated, uncertain of my loyalties. Outside my window, I could see John Tucker in the courtyard with a tape measure. He appeared to be measuring the 100-year-old beams that supported the roof of the back porch. I knew what it was about, the historic register. I had a brainstorm.
Yuda, let me go up there with you. I've got to go through the attic and dig up some old documents on the house and the land for the historic preserve thing. I've been meaning to do it, and you could help me. We could tell him you were helping me look through stuff and that we just got carried away and beat the rugs and mopped the bathroom while we were at it, if he even notices. Yuda undertook the conspiracy with the relish of a criminal. I agreed to meet her at Doc Homer's in half an hour. The attic was pleasantly chilly and smelled of pine. Decades of summer heat had forced droplets of resin out of the rough floorboards, which in cooler weather hardened to little amber marbles that scattered in all directions as we shifted trunks and cardboard boxes. The afternoon is fixed in my memory with the sharp smell of resin and that particular amber rattle, like the sound of ball bearings rolling around in a box. It's surprising how much of memory is built around things unnoticed at the time. I was amazed by what we found. Doc Homer's disease had manifested itself mostly downstairs. Up here, our past was untouched by chaos. Stacked boxes of Hallie's and my old clothes, school papers, photo albums, and all kinds of other detritus stood in neat rows, labeled chronologically and by content. I felt overwhelmed by so much material evidence of our family's past. I couldn't think why he'd kept it. He was so practical. What conceivable use did he foresee for a box marked Alice Maternity, for example? But you don't ask questions of an attic. Museums are their own justification. Look, I said to Yuda, tipping up a cardboard box so she could see inside. Some 30 pairs of black orthopedic shoes stacked from small to large, toes up, neat as eggs in a crate. There was a little more variety than I'd remembered. Two pairs were rather dapper little saddle Oxfords, black and maroon. Another year, I vaguely did remember this, we'd been allowed to order them in charcoal suede. Yuda had a full front apron over her old trousers and a print blouse, and she looked prepared for anything. Her lavender hoop earrings matched her wedgies, and she'd tied a red handkerchief over her hair. I was tempted to ask what she'd been ripping up this morning. She bent over beside me and picked out one of the smallest shoes, cradling it like an orphaned bird. Law, he was so careful about you girls and your feet. I remember thinking, oh, mercy, when those girls get big enough to want heels, there's going to be the devil to pay. I laughed. He wasn't just careful. He was obsessed. Yuda looked down at me. He just wanted awful bad for you kids to be good girls, she said. It's hard for a man by himself, honey. You don't know how hard. He worried himself to death. A lot of people you know would just let their kids run ever which way. She stopped, cocking her head a little, staring at the shoe in her hand. One year for Christmas, I gave the two of you little cowboy outfits with guns, and you just loved them, but he had to take away the guns. He didn't want you killing, even pretend. I felt awful that I'd done that once I thought about it. He was right. As she talked, I remembered the whole story, the cowboy outfits and the guns. Hallie and I had tried to claim moral high ground, saying he was taking away what belonged to us. He stood in front of the window, his thin face turned to the light, speaking to the world outside. I will not have the neighbors arming my children like mercenaries. I'd looked up mercenaries in the dictionary later and felt ashamed. I explained the ethics of armament to Hallie. How long did you take care of us? I asked Yuda. Oh, I expect close to 10 years, all in all. Till you was about 14 and Hallie was 11. You remember that. You'd come up after school and we'd play old maid or you'd play swinging statues out in the yard. We had us a time, and I'd come up here at night when he had to go tend a baby or something. Sometimes of an evening, you'd run off with the Domingos kids without telling me where you'd gone. She laughed. I like to skinned you alive a couple of times. You girls was a couple of live potatoes. She was bad, and you was worse.
I remembered her arms when they were thinner, a younger Yuda. And I remembered standing at a kitchen counter, on a stool, patting out my own handprints in floured dough while she wove strips of pie crust, pale and thin as flayed skin, over and under to make a perfect pie top. I was experiencing a flash flood of memories. I feared I might drown in them. My skull was so crowded with images, it hurt.
"He raised you to be good girls," she said again.
She reached over and squeezed my upper arm before returning the shoe to its box. I didn't know what to tell her we were looking for the historical project. Anything documenting the age of the house would be helpful, and more generally, old photographs of any kind. Yuda seemed content to poke into boxes at random, but I tried to ground myself by reading labels. Crockery and flatware. Garden records. One bore the mystic title, Electricity. I looked inside. Socket hardware, lamp cord, the reflector from a heat lamp, a pair of rubber gloves. I couldn't resist getting sidetracked by one marked Artwork, H, age 3 to 6. The subjects of Hallie's crayon drawings were mainly the two of us, stick sisters holding hands, or else just me, my orangish hair radiating from my head like a storm of solar flares. There was not one figure anywhere representing Doc Homer. I wondered if he'd noticed, but he must have. He was the one who'd picked up each drawing, rescued it from destruction, and finally labeled the box, the invisible archivist of our lives. Out of curiosity, I tracked down the corresponding box called Artwork C. As I'd expected, it was full of family portraits. Big sister, little sister, father, mother, a cockeyed roof over our heads, and above that, an omnipresent yellow sun. It didn't resemble anyone's reality but mine, but there it was. Or maybe it wasn't so much a matter of reality as of expectation, what I felt the world owed me. I held two of our drawings side by side and concluded that there was no puzzle as to why we were different. Hallie and I had grown up in different families.
"Here's pictures," Yuda reported suddenly.
There was a whole aisle of boxes marked photographs with inscrutable suffixes. I picked up one marked photographs, AMJOURGEN, and found it surprisingly light, so I carried it over to the east window and sat down on a steamer trunk, settling the box on my lap before opening it. Inside were stacks of ancient 8x10s, their brown edges curled like autumn leaves. Each one was a photograph of a newborn baby with a startled-looking face and marble-white eyes. I leafed through them one after another, awestruck by the oddity of these children. Of course, I knew about the eyes, an anomaly of pigmentation that was genetic proof of Grisela heritage on both sides. But I'd never seen them. They tended to darken just hours after birth, and in modern times, a person can easily go through life, in Grace or anywhere, without seeing a newborn. On top of the stack of photos was a handwritten page with the heading, Notes on Methodology. The ink had faded to brown. This would all be for his genetics paper, Doc Homer's careful notations on how he'd set up the camera, the distance, the amount of light. Apparently he'd rigged some setup that used powerful flashbulbs, the old-fashioned kind that popped once and then were used up. It was before the days of modern electronics. All those babies. How they must have screamed 1 second after he shot them in the name of science. Or in the name of his own desire to set himself apart. What could be more arrogant than to come back and do a scientific study of your own townspeople, like so many natives in Borneo? I looked through the photos again and kept coming back to one that had an arresting familiarity. The eyes looked back as if they knew me. I stared at the baby for a long time. It was me.
"You were a doll baby," Yuda said. She was looking down over my shoulder.
"That's me? Are you sure?" She took the stack and shuffled through it like a card trick. She produced another photo.
"There's Hallie.
You didn't look a thing alike when you were born. To her, the eyes were commonplace, not a feature to connect us, but they were the only feature I could see. To me, we looked identical. I held the two photographs up to the light, mystified. The eyes were unearthly. We were two babies, not of this world, just like every other one in the stack of photos. Two more babies of Grace. He was doing exactly the opposite of setting himself apart. He was proving we belonged here, were as pure as anybody in Grace. Both sides. Our mother's name was Althea. Her family despised him. "We're puro," I said out loud, and then I dropped the photograph because I heard the broken glass pop of the flash and went blind. I heard myself make an odd little whimper. Then Yuta appeared in my field of vision, moving away. "Cody, hon, I'm going on downstairs and beat the rugs or something. I'll try not to scare up too much dust." Chapter 23, The Souls of Beasts. Hallie, I'm going to die.
I'm Cody.
I'm dying. Well, I know. We all are, more or less. After a lifetime on the emotional austerity plan, my father and I were caving into melodrama. When I put my hand on his hand, it lay dead on the sheet. It was the diagnosis that killed him. Sometimes that's how it happens. "Where is Hallie?" "Please don't ask me that again. We don't know where she is. Don't worry about her right now, okay? We can't do anything." He looked at me accusingly. "You shouldn't have stood on the slide. I defended you on principle, but it was dangerous." How do people live with loved ones after their minds have fallen into anarchy? I rejected his ruined monologues every day, still expecting order to emerge victorious in Doc Homer's universe. I can remember once seeing a monument somewhere in the desert north of Tucson, commemorating a dedicated but ill-informed platoon of men who died in a Civil War battle 6 months after Lee had surrendered at Appomattox. That's exactly who I was, a soldier of the lost cause, still rooting for my father's recovery. Pain reaches the heart with electrical speed, but truth moves to the heart as slowly as a glacier. He'd gone off the tacrine, his experimental drug. The doctors in Tucson found his liver was wrecked from it. Now his mind scuttled around like a crab, heading always for the dark corners. People with this disease can linger on for 6 or 7 years, I'd read, and on average they do, but Doc Homer wouldn't. "Do you want something to eat? You'd have brought over this thing made out of crackers and walnuts and apples. It looks like one of your concoctions." "No, thank you." His bedroom was the largest upstairs room, with dark green walls and a high white ceiling and dormer windows across the west side. As children, Hallie and I rarely came into this room. It held an aura of importance and secrecy, the two things that most attract and frighten children. But for 2 days now, I'd been taking care of Doc Homer here, and when I stopped to notice, I found myself the most commanding presence in the room. I felt long-legged and entitled and strode around in my boots, adjusting curtains and moving furniture to suit myself. I'd tried to close the blinds, but he wanted them open. He insisted on the light, so I let it be. I'd been keeping a restless vigil by his bed throughout the late afternoon, watching for signs of a lucid moment. I'd about decided it wasn't coming. I pulled my chair closer and squeezed his hand hard in an effort to make him pay attention. "Pop, I want to talk to you about Mother." "Her kidneys were weak, and we knew it was a possibility. She had already had one episode of renal failure with the first pregnancy. She knew the risk." I didn't really try to absorb this information. "Her name was Althea. How was she related to Doña Althea?"
"No relation,"
the answer quick and firm.
"What relation? I know she came from here. I found some things in the attic. What was she, a great niece?"
"What things in the attic?"
Cousin? I crossed my arms like the obstinate child I was. No answer. Granddaughter? His face changed.
Malcriado.
Doña Altea's family didn't want you to marry her, right? He let out a short, bitter little laugh, unlike any sound I'd ever heard him make.
We were nolinas.
Just the way he said it told me plenty. And you married her anyway. You eloped. I leaned forward and touched his forehead, something I'd never done. It felt cool and thin-skinned like a vegetable. That's so romantic. Don't you know that's what all of us would like to think our parents did? You didn't have to hide something like that from us.
You understand nothing.
He seemed very lucid. At times I suspected him of feigning his confusion, or at least using it to his advantage. That's probably true, I said, withdrawing my hand.
We were a bad family.
Try to understand. We learned it in school, along with the multiplication tables and the fact that beasts have no souls. I could accept the verdict, or I could prove it wrong. You did that. You proved it wrong. In the slanted afternoon light, his eyes were a cloudy blue and his skin was translucent. He looked up at the ceiling and I had a disturbing view of his eyes in profile.
I proved nothing, he said. I became a man with no history, no guardian angels. I turned out to be a brute beast after all. I didn't redeem my family. I buried it, and then I built my grand house on top of the grave. I changed my name.
You still have plenty of guardian angels.
I don't think anybody in this town remembers that I'm a Nolina.
No, you're wrong about that. They do remember. I think people are sorry. And they love you. Look at your refrigerator.
He gave me an odd, embittered look. How could he not know this was true? Refrigerators don't preserve love, he said.
The hell they don't. Yours does. The women in this town bake you casseroles and pies like the world was going to end. He made a slight sound by breathing out of his nose. He seemed strangely like a child. They probably can't forgive themselves for the past, I said. Mother died before they could get everything straightened out. And then you kind of took your phone off the hook, emotion-wise. He looked away from me again.
We aren't from here. We came from the outside. That is our myth, and every person in Grace believes it, because they want to. They don't want to see a Nolina when they look at me. They want a man they can trust with their children's ear infections. And I am that man. If you change the present enough, history will bend to accommodate it.
No, I'm pretty sure you're wrong about that. What's true is true, no matter how many ways you deny it. He closed his eyes for a while. I'd never seen him frail or impaired. All the time I'd been his daughter, he'd never been sick. How long are you going to stay in bed? I asked softly, in case he was falling asleep.
I'm exhausted.
I know, but after you rest, you might want to get up for a while. I can warm up some soup.
He didn't open his eyes. Do you think Hallie is coming back?
I don't know what to think. We have to think yes, don't we?
You're the advocate of ordained truth. Are you telling me now that we can will Hallie back to safety?
No, I don't guess we can. We just have to wait. It was the first honest conversation we'd had about Hallie. It took us both by surprise. We were quiet for a long time then, but I knew he wasn't sleeping. I could see his eyes working back and forth under his eyelids as if he were reading his own thoughts. I wondered what his thoughts looked like in his clear moments and in his confusion. I very much wished to know him. Pop? He slowly opened his eyes and looked at the ceiling. Did you really see me bury the baby? He looked at me. Why didn't we ever talk?
He sighed. You get beyond a point.
You could have just given me a hug or something.
He turned away from me. His short gray hair stood up in whorls on the back of his head. He said, "It's Friday."